Were you or was Matthias involved in the writing of this compromise?
As far as I can remember, which is pretty dim, he was. I wasn't. Again, I wasn't doing the staff work on this.
Who would have been?
Basically, I think the same folks who were involved in the earlier rounds of drafting.
But nobody on Matthias' staff would
no.
have been.
No, not really.
Bill Emerson wouldn't have.
Well, he may have been to the extent I was, which was that we would talk with a lot of people, but when it came down to the crucial meetings, you know, back when.
Charles Horsley was, there's a lot of information being sent out of the White House
right.
saying, what about this, and the compromise plans.
Mm-hmm.
What was his interest in all of this?
Charlie Horsley is a very dedicated D.C. advocate. Had been very involved in local community affairs and had gotten this position in the White House as basically the staff person for D.C. affairs, assistant to the president, which was a very novel position. And he was working this one about as hard as any administration, legislative liaison works any legislation. So that, you know, he was involved in all the details of this the way that, say, the legislative people at Treasury get involved in the details of a tax bill or something. And was really the administration catalyst for it and the contact point and negotiator and all the rest.
Would there have been input from the commissioners or were they simply on the other side, totally McMillan?
No, not entirely. To Briner, for one, was very receptive to home rule, quite staunch in saying that his job was not the ideal arrangement. I think on some of the technical aspects of city government, they were very much involved, but mostly it was you know, the game was being played on the Hill to a large extent.
One of the curious things about the bill for me was that Matthias agreed to the dehatching of federal employees. The Hatch Act would not apply to these local elections.
That is not too novel. There's also a Hatch Act exemption for so-called federally impacted communities, such as parts of Montgomery County. And in fact, some of the very strong nonpartisan coalition groups in Montgomery County local politics have included an awful lot of federal employees. And particularly if you're having nonpartisan elections, it makes sense in a place like the district to allow federal employees to be very much involved because they're some of the most talented people in the community. The fact that Montgomery County was also, you know, an area with a large percentage of federal employees who did get involved made this one a lot easier.
One of the amendments at the last minute to try to rescue this was one by Congressman Bell. What's his name? California.
Al.
Yeah. creating a nonpartisan electoral system, which gained the support of people like Royce and Malter, but were opposed by Udall and Sickles.
Mm-hmm.
Did Mathias have a position on nonpartisan?
Can't remember at that point. That was one of the many maneuverings that were going on.
Apparently, Horsley thought that he had the votes to pass the thing without this Bell Amendment, as it turns out.
I'm not sure who was sort of more ingenuous about it at that point, Charlie Horsley or Abe Mulder.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them really did the parliamentary homework, although it was hard to best Judge Smith and McMillan at parliamentary maneuvers. To an extent that should have been a little embarrassing, although it's a little hard to say that because none of us thought of it either. This whole endlessly fussed over and committed and compromised and rewritten and organized effort really got blindsided on the floor.
And defeated rather soundly. This CISC bill, self-government referendum and charter board.
Collected a lot of people.
Yeah.
For all the various reasons we've been over.
What was the role of Jack Nevius in all of this? I guess it's Nevius.
Right. Jack has been for some years one of the basically liberal D.C. Republicans who were trying very hard to mobilize Republican support for home rule, for a variety of other progressive positions in the district or involving the district. The, of course, D.C. Republican Party has gone through about as many metamorphoses as the National Party has over the years. In those years, it was still quite a progressive and integrated Republican Party. And was trying very diligently to help get support on the Hill as well as to locally sort of remove a certain amount of the sense that home rule was really a democratic cause with a capital D. So that Jack and the Home Rule Committee and a lot of local people who took the whole effort very seriously were constantly trying one way after another to advance almost anything that would give people in the district more of a franchise. Without lots of success, I might add, until Johnson reorganized the city government and they began to be able to show what they could do.
One of the letters I sent you, Nevius is trying to get Mathias to drum up some Republican support for Morris. Home Rule Rider. And Bill Emerson solicits your opinion on this. Do you know what happened with that?
I'm not sure. Morris, I assume, was Senator Morris from Oregon, who was a great advocate of Home Rule. And you see, the Senate would keep sending things over, the Senate having no germaneness rule. And they kept trying, but it got to be basically ridiculous. Max note on there. It's okay with me if futile is about the way it was.
Futility suggests that probably you file that away.
Excuse me. Well, it suggests that if they want to have breakfast, you help them have breakfast. But you don't... really break your spear too many times on something that just isn't getting anywhere.
What was the role of the Metropolitan Washington Board of Trade in all of this? Did Matthias have contacts there?
Well, oh yeah. One of the things that happens when you're in Congress, particularly from the area, is that you do meet city people and downtown people, in addition to all the lobbyists from downtown that, of course, you see. Until the late 60s, Board of Trade was very conservative. It was, to its credit, one of the groups that really rose to the occasion in 68 and 69 when the city badly needed some business leadership. But before that, it was quite conservative. And was, you know, had not done badly under the old system. I mean, to a large extent, of course, one of the things that had developed in the district was a great kind of lassitude about local government. There wasn't any particular pressure on it to do a lot. There was no electoral pressure, there was no electoral accountability, there was no politicking, there was no pork barrel, except insofar as it came from the Hill. You know, no aldermen out there drumming up projects for my neighborhood. There was a largely white police force that was a source of increasing complaint and concern. There were a fairly troglodyte school administration. And the district was sort of going downhill without anyone doing much. The business community was fairly passive. Again, the real erosion of the district's economy had begun, but it wasn't too evident by then. And other than home rules and crime, the major issues of the area that came to the Hill involved highways and metro. So the business community wasn't in bad shape. They didn't think they were in bad shape. And
were they wrong about the arguments that they made against this bill, that there wasn't enough federal payment, that the net result would be increasing suburban flight, that a bunch of non-Washingtonians would vote all sorts of bond issues and then move back home and not end up paying them?
They were certainly wrong about the last one. The city hasn't, as it turned out, the city only recently became eligible to issue bonds. As far as the federal payment, if you listen to the city, it's never enough. Never could be enough. They're now arguing over whether the federal government should pay for a new jail, which I find an astonishing assertion, but that one's still going on. As far as suburban flight, I think they were wrong. It's hard to tell since home rule didn't really come in until 73, by which time a lot of the flight had occurred. But the district, even by the mid-60s, was so obviously overwhelmingly black, that any flight that would have been precipitated by, for instance, school desegregation had already happened, long since happened. Happened in the 50s. And what you do see over the years after that is, on the one hand, this kind of middle-class black movement into primarily Prince George's, which was accelerated to a certain extent in the late 60s and early 70s, and then the gentrification of areas like Capitol Hill, which had already started, which picked up again. So that I don't know that home rule had much of a real effect on that, unless you measure home rule as starting from the reorganization in 67, which produced a black mayor, even though he was appointed.
The other thing I noticed in the files on home rule was a good bit of literature from a group called the Council of Republican Organizations. The local lobbyist was somebody named Jack Salona. Does that ring a bell at all?
Not a loud one. Not without looking at it. Not sure.
Apparently it was Ripon Society and a whole group of other sorts of liberal Republican, moderate Republican organizations, as they were known.
Right. Or progressives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Grouped together. I just never had encountered this group before.
I'm not sure about that particular umbrella, but certainly the Ripon group, including Jack, were generally young and quite progressive Republicans who had were involved in a number of issues trying to advance ideas that were not generally coming out of the Republican leadership in Congress, particularly in the Goldwater years. It's bad when you can't read your own writing.
You can't, or I can't?
You can't, you said.
Yes. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the D.C. delegate. In fact, a series of bills and attempts to create, which I think probably were going on before you came.
Right.
And, it was in 1965, Mathias introduced a D.C. delegate bill. He introduced them previously, which apparently went nowhere. And I was this a... This would not have been D.C. committee, would it have?
I don't think so.
I think it's Judiciary Committee.
Yeah. Those, of course, eventually a D.C. delegate was established and still exists. It would not have been a Mathias bill, simply because he was in the minority. But that was one of the perpetual efforts, part of extending the ability of D.C. residents to have some voice in the councils where they were governed.
Mm-hmm. There were varieties of attempts during this period in the attaching the D.C. delegate to the D.C. Election Extension Act, an attempt to attach it as an amendment to the Legislative Reorganization Act of 1966, none of which apparently got very far. What was Matthias's position on the delegate in a kind of ideal sense? Would he have liked to have seen senators and representatives?
At that point, I frankly am not sure. My memory's a little dim on that. It was one of these, in that wonderful large category of good ideas that it was hard to advance simply because you were fighting an awful lot of inertia. I think the notion of a delegate for the district was probably the least controversial extension of any kind of franchise or political voice.
Yeah.
It was precedented, of course, because there were non-voting delegates from the territories and had been for 200 years, more or less. But it was just hard to persuade very many people that this was a burning issue with any urgency about it.
Was that principally because D.C. by this point was heavily black, or was it?
Well, it was as much because people who not only are disfranchised, but who live in a compact area that is not in your state, become of very little interest to a lot of politicians who basically would not oppose that kind of a step. But it was just one of a number of good proposals that was dormant for a long time, and a few people kept poking at it, and eventually it happened.
Oh, a lot of what's in the D.C. delegate files come from a man named Sturgis Warner, who apparently was in a Washington law firm.
Right.
What was his interest in all of this?
Sturgis Warner, like a number of other people, Jack Nevius to an extent, and a number of people with the League of Women Voters locally, were just very dogged on the subject. Warner, who's a very savvy lawyer, was involved in an awful lot of the bills affecting D.C. elections, efforts to improve the whole structure of franchise in the district for years. And it was a crusade for them. It was really their issue.
So there really wasn't any kind of economic or political interest for them?
Well, there wasn't, not in the sense that they wanted the job. It was a good government issue. It was a very logical thing. They cared, as people who were committed to the city and who personally, you know, were unrepresented on the Hill.
For each of these people, was Nevius, was Warner, were they people who had grown up in D.C.? Or you may not know.
I actually don't know. But I know that they were very much involved with city affairs and very committed to it. And the intensity of their support for it was simply a lot higher. It wasn't a matter of more or less support for the principle. It's just become what they decided to work on. And it was a very good thing, because you need that kind of person. In both their cases, particularly Warner's, they were also extremely good technically. Warner had a large influence on a number of the D.C. elections bills in this area, just in terms of the mechanical provisions.
He wrote them.
Yeah, and
to be more precise.
Well, you needed somebody like that who was as much a lobbyist as, say, an industry lobbyist, and was a tremendous resource, as well as a constant nag, which you need. But it was simply a matter in the delegate case, I think, as much as anything, is overcoming a lot of inertia on the Hill. People kept having more important things to think about.
What was the role of Mo Udall in this campaign? I noticed a lot of the things that went to Matthias went carbon copies to Udall.
Udall's basically was a very constructive force. And was kind of in the position that, say, Eagleton was later on the Senate side of wanting to expedite as much as possible.
Was he on the district committee?
Yeah. And, you know, those who were not intent on hanging on to authority were really much more and increasingly receptive, particularly after the reorganization of the city government, to what the appointed mayor and council wanted, and became much more friendly and much less autocratic.
My impression on the DC delegate bills is that the problem was much less a House one than a Senate one, and the problem of some sort of filibuster on this issue in the Senate. Why was the Senate more a problem for the delegate as opposed to home rule?
I think you're pushing my memory farther than it goes on that one.
All right. One of the arguments that Matthias made in all of this was that the necessity of representation for the district because there was no home rule.
Mm-hmm.
When home rule happened, what happens to that argument?
It changes, obviously. I don't think it's diluted. It just becomes more complex because, for example, as long as you have congressional oversight of a city government, it helps very much to have the city have representation on the Hill, even if it's non-voting. So that the delegate then becomes in the position of any representative from back home with something to speak about, something on which he has to deal with his colleagues. It also, home rule does not diminish the argument about having a local voice in national issues. It doesn't affect that at all. You're still subject to federal taxation, you're still subject to the draft, you're still subject to all of the federal aid or the lack of it that any other jurisdiction is subject to.
How did the Nixon White House figure in all of this, the home rule, the DC delegate?
The Nixon White House was, as far as I can remember, reasonably accommodating. And refreshingly free of, with the exception of the criminal justice system, of possessive instincts over the district. Now, obviously, crime is a big exception, and it was a particularly big exception in 69 and 70. But except in that area, they were in one of their more progressive moods. And you know, it eventually happened during the Nixon administration. With the...
Were there particular people in the White House who...
Well, there were a series
of
sort of successors to Charlie Horsky, various people who had, although not exclusive D.C. jurisdiction, there was always someone on the White House staff who had jurisdiction over D.C. affairs. One of them was a guy named Bud Crowe, who got involved not only in home rule legislation, but the biggest, the most expensive, certainly, big ticket item in terms of local projects that went was the subway. And the Nixon administration backed the funding for the subway and was terribly helpful at a number of key points in what became a very intricate battle involving highway projects and a lot of mutual vetoes of things. They were generally very good on those issues. There's one of the things that did happen that helped the whole home rule issue is simply you got a new cast of characters gradually. McMillan was eventually gone. Judge Smith, of course, was gone. The House became a lot easier to work with. New issues got introduced, such as the subway, and the fact that the Capitol didn't really collapse entirely after the riots in 68. So that the whole climate changed. It got a little less focused on black-white issues